Welcome to another insightful episode of Medical Narratives Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Gordon, a geriatrician from Toronto. Today, we are honored to have a remarkable guest, Dr. Celine Guo, a young and thoughtful geriatrician who completed her geriatric oncology fellowship in Toronto last year and is currently practicing in Calgary. Our focus today revolves around the intersection of geriatrics and oncology, the nuances of medical oncology and the care of older patients, and much more. Welcome, Dr. Guo. The C word, cancer, can have a profound impact on individuals' life. How does it shape the experiences and perspectives of individuals facing a cancer diagnosis, particularly in the older population?
Thank you so much for the invitation to this podcast, Dr. Gordon. I think cancer itself has such a dramatic influence in anyone's lives, but in particular in older adults who might have had experiences with other family members or colleagues who have gone through cancer diagnosis, sometimes much earlier on in their life. The word cancer often has a very terminal implication. The treatments sometimes that they've seen 20, 30 years ago can be quite a negative experience for them from other people. So I think it's really a life-changing diagnosis, and oftentimes it raises questions about what is the prognosis, what are the side effects, what are the treatments, how can this person expect to live their life going forward. And there are studies showing that for older adults, it's not just the duration of life that is important to them going through cancer treatment, but also the quality of life, their symptom control, and their function at the end of all of this. So these are all important things to consider when treating older adults with cancer.
Yeah, I remember a scene in the movie Brighton Beach Memoirs, in which somebody was explaining something, and when they came to say the word cancer, they whispered it. Mrs. Jones has cancer.
Yes.
And that was a reflection of the fear and how one wouldn't even talk about it because it had such a terrible negative implication and fear. Mm-hmm. So would you describe, please, the unique considerations and challenges associated with medical oncology care when it pertains to older individuals? How does the age factor into approach and treatment plans?
So older adults, there's two aspects to this, I believe. One is that as normal aging occurs, the body, the physiologic systems, organs, most of them are all impacted by aging. And most of the organ system have decreased physiologic reserve to resist or handle the effects of cancer, but also the effects of the treatments. And then the other aspect that makes things a little bit more challenging is that older adults are quite heterogeneous and quite diverse in their health and function. You can have older 80-year-olds who are running marathons versus 60-year-olds who are living with severe frailty and not able to do their basic day-to-day functions. So that diversity makes it very difficult for oncologists or the treatment team to find out what is the actual appropriate treatment plan and fit the standard treatment plan that was done in randomized controlled trials in very young and healthy patients to this diverse population. So I think those are the two unique challenges.
Yeah, I'm going to give you a little anecdote that I think highlights that, that dealt with myself, because I was about in my 70s when I was diagnosed, early 70s, with multiple myeloma. And I sought the advice of a hematologist oncologist at one of the teaching hospitals in Toronto. And she asked if I wanted a second opinion. So she sent me to Princess Margaret, which, of course, is our mecca of oncology. And I saw the expert there in multiple myeloma, who basically said the same thing about my condition and chemotherapy that had been recommended, and asked if I would like to be treated at Princess Margaret or at the other hospital. And I said, I'd like to stay at the other hospital because I really found the physician who was looking at me very thoughtful, empathetic, et cetera. So I was treated for multiple myeloma with the usual cocktail of drugs, and I did very well for a couple of years. But it was interesting when I asked her, and just in my training experience, multiple myeloma was terrible. I mean, I trained at the time that the only treatment was nitrogen mustard, was a terrible treatment, and you died. And then gradually, so she said, I said, well, what's my prognosis? She said, well, if you tolerate the drugs, maybe you'll get 2, 2.5 years. I thought, wow, all of a sudden I have to start thinking differently about my life. I was working and I was going and I was doing well. And then I started the usual, my numbers started deteriorating. He said, well, let's try a different cocktail. And a new cocktail, the usual chemotherapeutic cocktails. And I said, well, what about now? What's my prognosis? She says, well, maybe you'll get another 2 years. So I said, okay, so now I'm 4 years. I'm better than in my training. So that cocktail worked for a while, and then it started failing. And she said, I'd like to try something new. There's a whole new collection of medications out there. I mean, we see them on television, Every new drug, every new condition has another drug out there. I said, for sure. And I was looking up on my own on, it's called Myeloma Beacon, a very good website. So we started that, but it was a much more intense therapy. I would spend a whole day in the medical day treatment infusions, but my numbers plummeted. I was doing well, but in the meanwhile, I had developed cardiac amyloid and renal amyloid as side effects of the multiple myeloma, but I was managing. Anyway, after 2 years of treatment, my numbers had come down to zero. And she said, you know what? I think we'll just stop the chemotherapy. You're doing well. And a couple of months later, over a 3 day period, I developed an acute confusional state. I went to the eMERGE of that hospital. An eMERGE physician saw me. He said, this is a probably rapidly developing dementia in an 80-year-old, a 79-year-old. I was admitted to the hospital. They worked me up. They couldn't find anything. I mean, they found, bacteria in the urine, which anybody who's got a prostate has that. So they treated that. And I was sent home. And then a week later, I came back in urinary retention, and they put in a catheter and another bacterial. But the meanwhile, I was absolutely confused. I couldn't do my banking. I couldn't log into anything. My wife took over, and basically, they admitted me to palliative care. They couldn't figure out what was wrong with me. My blood pressure was low, etc. And it was only when I got better by myself and I was able to once again do my computer, I looked it up, and it turns out the drug I was on was a newer drug, and it was only one case report of chemo brain. And I thought, that's it. So I saw my hematologist. I asked, she had said, I have nothing to do for you anymore. When I saw her, she said, we must have missed the boat. And the thing is, it can happen to anybody. But what was there was the fact that because the chemotherapy had been stopped a couple of months earlier, nobody thought about the fact as an 80-year-old with renal insufficiency, that drug was hanging around. And then with some other modifications of drugs, I returned to normal function. In fact, my numbers are zero now. I mean, she says, I can't really call it a cure, but it's a very, 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 very good remission. And if I had been a younger person, I am certain I would have been looked at differently because it would be so unusual. So just as a one example, but it was a very personal example, how easy it is. And it wasn't that somebody made a mistake. It was a very common view that if at this age you have something, it must be something awful. Anyway, so let's
Very powerful
go.
example.
Okay, so look, you're a geriatrician. So what advantages do you see in having a geriatrician involved in oncological care of older patients? How does this specialized approach contribute to the overall being of the older patient with a malignancy?
So this is a great question, and this is with the bulk of my fellowship learning about the advantages of involving a geriatrician in oncologic care. And now that there are a couple randomized controlled trials, so nice level one evidence showing that having comprehensive geriatric assessment prior to oncology decision making helps uncover vulnerabilities that is not picked up on standard oncology assessments. And this can in turn help with predicting future chemotherapy toxicity or surgical risk complications, as well. Factors from the geriatric assessment can help predict competing life expectancy. And so looking at both the benefit of cancer treatment and the risks of cancer treatment in a more accurate way than just the eyeball test. And this has been shown to help decrease overall serious adverse effects, something that might send a patient to hospital, serious adverse effects by 10 to 20% in patients receiving chemotherapy. And that is a huge benefit. I don't know much other interventions that can decrease chemotherapy toxicity that much. So in addition, there has been other randomized controlled trials, in particular, the Integrate trial that has shown to also, if you have a geriatrician involved in the co-management of the oncology treatment process, it can improve quality of life, decrease healthcare utilization, decrease emergency room visits, all these really important markers that both for the person, the patient being treated, and for the healthcare system.
Yeah, I use the analogy in my earlier days of doing geriatrics. The orthopedic surgeons realized that having a geriatric preoperative assessment and postoperative follow-up was a benefit to them, because their real concern is the surgery went well and then the person had problems and there was a bed that they couldn't free. And I worked out a protocol with the orthopods that was at Mount Sinai Hospital, in which of a certain group of people, I would do the pre-op. And it wasn't so much as the typical pre-op, which sort of said fit for surgery, that gave you nothing. The real thing was to outline what the risks were, not from the surgery. I mean, obviously, you don't want to lose blood no matter who you are, but it was always the post-operative care, because I almost made my bread and butter for a while being called to orthopedic post-operative when the nurse said, Mrs. So-and-so must have had a stroke. I said, why? She's very confused. Mm-hmm. Well, I used to say, no, I think she must have not had a stroke. And it became clear that they had to modify their post-operative protocols to decrease the risk of what was in fact delirium. Mm-hmm. And that saved the orthopods a lot of heartache, because they want to operate because that's what people need. There are people waiting in a merge with broken hips. Mm-hmm. So I think there's an analogy, but you have to convince the people who have their standard approach what we is. I mean, look, I'm biased and you're biased, but we know what we're doing because we've seen it, mm-hmm. of offering our view to help that person get through. I mean, the chemotherapy is really important, mm-hmm. but it's not easy therapy.
No.
I know, having had chemotherapy, it's not easy. Mm-hmm. So you have to help people. And sometimes having a geriatrician, as you mentioned from the studies, can facilitate, one, the person accepting the treatment, but also making sure that the risk factors of their other comorbidities are addressed. So let's go to the next. Aging comes with its own set of health challenges. And we're all aware of what we often call the aging demographic or the demographic imperative. What are the top oncological diseases that significantly impact the elderly population? And how does addressing these differ from caring for younger patients?
If you look at the overall cancer demographic, about 70% of patients are 65 and older. And if you look at the mortality of in cancer, the brunt of 75% approximately of the patients are 65 and older as well. So the older population definitely bears the brunt of oncologic disease burden. So some cancers, like, for example, multiple myeloma. I was just speaking with one of the multiple myeloma specialists in Calgary, actually, and he was saying his average age is probably 70. So multiple myeloma is definitely one of the illnesses, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and then in the solid tumor side, prostate cancer, breast cancer, now that the individuals are living longer with all the breast cancer treatment, and even the GI cancers, the colon cancers, and then the more endocrine cancer, the pancreatic cancers. A lot of these cancers have an older age predominance. Myself, I'm working with the prostate cancer or the GU cancer group to try and start working on geriatric oncology in Calgary. And they do see that with the older population there, the needs are just complex. There are multiple, is a stronger focus on the functional impairments that might come from the cancer itself or the complications from treatment. And also, there might be other comorbidities like heart disease or lung disease that might complicate both the treatment process and also the development symptoms. If someone on hormone therapy for prostate cancer develop fatigue, is it the hormone therapy? Is it the prostate cancer? Is it their heart failure? Or is there are they deconditioned? So it becomes a very complex picture to try and tease apart these different aspects. And whereas for younger patients, if they're more of a single disease system, that's a bit more of a straightforward picture. And I think the one other aspect is the social challenges for older adults. Is particularly if they don't have family support or close ties to help them support through the process in terms of transportation, obtaining food, that can be quite challenging for older adults too.
No, happy you mentioned that because I think all of us who deal with the older population, whether geriatricians, care of the elderly, everybody, know that the psychosocial aspects of their life matter a lot. I find, even though I'm now working in a memory clinic, because I'm a geriatrician, I don't just look for the head up, and I have the family, and a lot of our time is spent figuring out what to do beyond the disease. What to do, because people are isolated. The family, even if they're in the same city, they may not live in the same neighborhood. And then the whole issue with trans, as you mentioned, transportation, whether they can drive, could they take an Uber, somebody has to pick them up. And that goes beyond the treatment. But if somebody needs to go to many places to get their treatments, you have to make sure how they're going to get there. Who's going to take them? Do you have a family? Do you have one of these networks to take them? So if you exclude those, or something as simple as how do they eat? Can they make their own food? I mean, you want them to have good nutrition?
That's
Do
right.
you get meals on wheels?
Yes,
Do they order
exactly.
in? If they're ordering, what kind of food are they ordering? And most physicians who aren't kind of focused on the care of the elderly usually don't think in those terms. I mean, we try to now educate. And then I have a special interest in the ethical issues that come up is, well, what happens if? What happens if it doesn't work and you develop a terrible side effect? Do you want to keep pumping new drugs or do you want to be left alone? And if you don't pursue that, you may miss out on something very important that nobody had planned for. Now, in the dynamic field of oncology, because as somebody who's been around for a long time, I've watched amazing changes in all of medicine, but oncology for sure, because things, as I said, multiple myeloma in my training, you had maybe 1.5 years of a really miserable life, right? So in the dynamic field, one of the most recent scientific breakthroughs and advancements specifically tailored to improving the care and outcomes in the older patient.
I'll start with just mentioning immunotherapy and targeted therapy very briefly. I'm not an oncologist, so it's not my field of extra expertise, but there's so much scientific breakthrough in that field, and I think it's worth so I think it's worth mentioning that a lot of times the adverse effects from these therapies are less burdensome than the adverse effects from chemotherapy, which most of the time can be quite harsh. I think the average percentage of older patients who develop serious adverse effects on chemotherapy is about 50%. So that's quite a high number. So the immunotherapy and targeted therapy are really quite promising for older adults, although I think that their use in older adults is still a field that needs to be investigated. It's a potential for more research, for sure. And then, in terms of helping elderly patients in the more supportive side, I think the idea of just doing a geriatric assessment or having oncologists involved with elderly patients itself is quite an advancement and a development, and trying to that's worthwhile being looked at in multiple cancer centers and trying to get a more holistic view on treatment decision making as well as management of their function. And oftentimes there's the question of what's the difference between a geriatric assessment versus palliative care? And I think palliative care has been shown to be so essential and important in oncology and increases life expectancy, but it's still a little bit different from geriatrics, where we focus on the step before, where we have the expertise to identify vulnerabilities for the treatment decision making, and then also a target function and target improving their quality of life, not just from the symptoms perspective, but maybe optimize their medical comorbidities, optimize their functional status to try and help them before, beyond the symptom stage.
I'm going to use myself as an example. I feel like I'm a textbook of elderly oncology. So, because I had the multiple myeloma, I developed amyloid of the heart, which gives me some diastolic dysfunction. And one of my symptoms developed was fatigue. And the assumption initially was, well, I had some anemia from the chemotherapy and this and that. And it was looked at by the oncologist as part of my multiple myeloma. But because I had cardiac amyloid, she asked a cardiologist to see me, who follows me. And it turned out I had interesting cardiac condition, which included diastolic dysfunction and probably mild heart failure. So I was put on furosemide, 20 milligrams a day. You know what furosemide 20 milligrams a day cost? I think it's 0.1 cents. I saw the first dose of furosemide given intravenously as a medical student in Dundee, Scotland,
Oh, wow.
and it was miraculous. This woman came in and gross pulmonary edema from atrial fibrillation and rheumatic mitral stenosis, and they often died. We treat them with digitalis, with morphine, with tourniquets. She got a dose of this drug, which I didn't know what it was. I was a medical student. And in 20 minutes, she said, "Oh, I feel much better." And the bed was soaked. It was
Okay.
miraculous. So the cardiologist gave me 20 milligrams of oral Lasix, about furosemide, and my symptoms went away. Now, there's an example of the comorbidity that could easily be overlooked if you weren't looking at the whole person, because I didn't have obvious symptoms of heart failure in terms of my ankles weren't swollen, my gut, but it was because of it's an unusual because amyloid causes like a cardiomyopathy. So there's an example that the quality of life of mine changed completely. And I think we, as geriatricians, we focus on all these other things that are often overlooked. And that's really important, especially when dealing with cancer alone is difficult. So that's really great. Now, here's something that I think is important in terms of healthcare delivery. So obviously, geriatricians, there are a few of us around in the country. I don't know what the latest number is. It was probably 200 plus some years ago. Now, we, especially compared to the United States, we don't do primary care in geriatrics. In the United States, many geriatricians really do primary care of older people. It's a very different framework. So we've tried to increase our influence on care of the elderly. But primary care physicians, basically, the way they're structured in Canada is, and that's one of the problems, we have a shortage, but primary care physicians play a crucial journey in the healthcare care of older oncological patients. Could you elaborate on what specific responsibilities and contributions of primary care physicians in ensuring comprehensive and effective care for this population and how they would interface with the geriatricians in addition to the oncologists?
I think primary care physicians play such a crucial role in all of healthcare, and then in particular in oncology patients. I've seen the challenge that without a good primary care physician can have. Even I think from the geriatrician point of view, from our we can help identify the issues, like for example, and when I was in Toronto working with Shabir, we did have a patient with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma who was just being monitored but had heart failure that was very difficult to diurese. And he didn't have a primary care physician that he could go to regularly. So I ended up being calling him and his son every week to follow up with his heart failure management. And I could do that because I was a trainee and I had the time, but it went in a full geriatric practice, we wouldn't have the capabilities to give that close follow-up to the patients. And that kind of patients would fall through the crack a little bit, not having that close follow-up. And so primary care physicians, I think, being there to look at, monitor these comorbidities longitudinally, having closer follow-up and picking up earlier with the development of maybe fatigue or functional decline, maybe not eating well, weight loss, picking up the development of these complications could be so helpful as a feedback to the specialist team to reevaluate them again earlier, or the oncologist reevaluating their illness. I think really it needs to be a kind of a collaborative team effort between primary care and all the specialists together. And primary care holds that position as the, I guess, all the specialists are referring, their recommendations come to primary care, and they consolidate all of that knowledge and see what is the best for the patient in front of him.
Yeah,
So I.
I don't know what things are like in Alberta. I know we have a big shortage in Ontario, but do you find that the primary care physicians are receptive to actually taking on that role, or is it deemed to be just too much for them? Because there is a group of primary physicians who have trouble dealing with the complexities of older patients.
Yes, I think that is a really fair point. I think with the primary care shortage and the overload of their patient numbers in their clinic, I think managing older patients can be really challenging, especially if they need closer follow-up. So it's more, it is a system-wide issue, I think, that, and if there's some way of adding the consultants and giving more support to the primary care physicians so that they're better able to care for these complex patients. I don't have a perfect solution, but I think it is a challenge for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is your sort of way it's structured where you are, is it a team of like social work, nurse practitioners, et cetera, so that you can spread the different responsibilities?
We do, yes, we do have a multidisciplinary team, which is very so beneficial. We have social work, pharmacy, nursing,
Hmm.
dietitians, and they have such valuable contributions as well.
Yeah, no, I think that most of us in the field realize that we alone as doctors can't run the show, and we've all had the experience of where the pharmacist or the dietitian is the person who picks up the clue to something that we've missed.
That's right.
And you know, however, even with this world of electronic everything, it's easy to miss things. And having different perspectives, especially I look at the social work for those who are really interested, because some of those problems in the social context can be the real barrier to a successful outcome.
That's right. Yes, and home
Anyway,
care
this was
too.
very, very exciting. So I really am pleased that you were able to join us this morning. And looking towards the future, what changes or improvements do you anticipate in the field of geriatric oncology? And how might these advancements shape our care landscape for older individuals facing cancer? I want you to be futuristic and optimistic.
I think there are a lot of really exciting developments. Geriatric oncology is just growing more and more every year as a field. A couple of things that I know that are coming is looking at more predictive models for geriatric oncology and immunotherapy, which currently most of the data for geriatric oncology is in patients receiving chemotherapy. So there is an expansion beyond that, looking at radiation therapy, immunotherapy, as well, and also in the surgical field. I think there is a surgical oncologist in Toronto who's doing a lot of the work on that too. And so beyond that, I know Shabir, Dr. Alibi is working on a project looking at remote symptom monitoring, and how that might benefit patients who are older. There's this a bit of bias, I guess, whether true or not, that older adults have difficulties with technology. So I think this will be really interesting to see the remote symptom monitoring. Is it effective and is it practical? Is it useful in the older patients? So I think there are attempts to do a more electronic form of the geriatric assessment. And this was done already in some of the randomized control trials, so that if you don't have a specialized geriatrician, at least you have standardized validated forms to evaluate each of the geriatric domains and look where there might be impairment, and then perhaps refer that patient on for further for physiotherapy or a dietitian for each of the domain marked. So I think those are all different strategies to try and increase geriatric oncology using whatever resources are available in the local setting.
Yeah, I think the issue with virtual, and I've now had some experience. I mean, very often older people come to the doctor with somebody, family member. And I've now had my own experiences of people who the travel was quite far, and they asked if we could have the meeting virtually. Now, the same care person was often a child, a daughter or son, was at the Zoom meeting. So the technology didn't depend on the older person. But
That's right.
instead of traveling, I remember I had one who was, it was Hamilton. Well, if you've driven from Hamilton, Toronto in the morning, it's a nightmare. So they asked if we could do it online. And it worked out very well because I still had the two of them together. So I think we can overcome, and also the technology could be made easier. I mean, there are no more options now, Zoom, Skype, WhatsApp, whatever, because most of the time we need another person to corroborate what we're doing. So I think there is a place for the virtual. Anyway, I think we're coming to the end of our podcast. I really want to thank you. I must say I've done many, many podcasts and I've had many guests. And even though our paths crossed only minimally when you were in Toronto, I'm really pleased to have met you now, I'll say virtually in person, and hear about your program and your work. And thank you for very much for joining us at Health Plexus.
Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. It's an honor to share a little bit of what I know about geriatric oncology.